This is Oreski Daoud, Principal Analyst at risk assessment firm Meir Risk LLC, and I am also the editor of the North Africa Journal. Welcome to Meir Risk Podcasts, where we discuss the root causes of instability in Africa and in the Middle East. Today is the 18th of November 2020, and I am very pleased to speak with Do Christophe Ouattara. Do Christophe is from NGO World Neighbors, an organization involved in humanitarian field in 13 countries, including Mali and Burkina Faso in the Sahel. World Neighbors provides support to communities in the areas of training, education, and other sectors that help communities cope with the challenges of hunger, poverty, and disease, among other things. Speaking from Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso, Do Christophe shares his insights on dealing with the challenges facing aid and humanitarian organizations, in this case active in the Sahel region. Among those challenges are the deteriorating security climate, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on communities, environmental degradation, and many other topics. So the first thing that I would love to know, who is WN or World Neighbors?
World Neighbors is an American-based NGO created in 1951, I think, and based in Oklahoma City. The mission of World Neighbors is to inspire people and strengthen communities to find lasting solutions to hunger, poverty, and disease, and to promote a healthy environment. World Neighbors is present in 13 countries. We have regions. We have Africa regions, Latin America and Caribbean regions, South Asia, and Southeast Asia. In Africa, we have West Africa, Burkina Faso, and in Mali. And in East Africa, you have Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania.
It's broad, but if I understand, you said 13 countries, so it's really manageable. Tell us about you a little bit, Do Christophe.
My name is Do Christophe Ouattara. I'm from Burkina Faso. And I joined World Neighbors since 2016. Mm-hmm. Before that, I was working with the government, Ministry of Environment, and Ministry of Agriculture, and Ministry of Livestock. So we are working in rural development sector. After 7 years of in public administration, I found that I wanted to make another experience with NGOs, and that's why I joined World Neighbors. And now I'm a senior program associate in the West Africa office.
Just to inform the listener, you are actually based in Burkina Faso.
Burkina Faso, yes.
And that's where you are today talking to us from. We are aware that the humanitarian sector, for lack of a better word, I would describe it as a pretty vibrant and busy in the Sahel. How big is the sector? I know it's very difficult to venture with a number of how many organizations are active in the region, but can you try to describe that sector from a like a 30,000 foot view?
Yes, in the Sahel, you know that in the Sahel, there are a lot of development problems and humanitarian issues. So there are many, many NGOs working to help communities to face all these constraints. So you have NGOs work doing development, and you have others who deal with humanitarian affairs, giving emergency aids, in case of outbreak of a crisis, for a crisis, for example. So there are a lot of actors involved in the sector in the Sahel.
And in terms of where they're from, it's mostly from the West, I would guess. U.S., Canada,
US,
Western Europe.
Canada, you're in Europe also.
In terms of assessing the need for humanitarian aid and assistance in the Sahel, give us sort of the lay of the land, looking at it from afar. Can you describe the region that you're helping for people who have never set foot in the Sahel?
You know, the Sahel is, we call it the Sahel band, is characterized by the heavy degradation on natural resources and lands. And in this area, people face many, many problems. And we as World Neighbors, we are working mostly in the remote areas where people are very in need, very poor areas. They rely on natural resources, agriculture, livestock. And with the degradation, climatic change, we have a lot of problems in this sector. When we enter in a community, we make a kind of assessment based on what the community, what are the assets there, on what we can rely on and try to build our intervention. And we try also to assess the social aspects. Is there a kind of leadership, and people can build an organization that can partner with World Neighbors in implementing the actions?
Is it fair to assume that most of the communities that you are supporting and helping have it generally a similar profile? You talked about environmental degradation. That's probably a common problem.
A common thing.
Is it fair to say that those villages are largely remote? They're isolated, perhaps?
It is remote areas. And the accessibility, the road condition also are very, very bad. Sometimes in the rainy season, you may have some flooding in the area. For them, we have farmers there, livestock breeders, all those together. We work with them in the community, villages.
Lack of water and power infrastructure is a big problem in terms of what sort of problems that these communities are facing?
Yes, they have, as I said, food problem, security, food security, health problem, because they are sometimes too far from the health centers, and natural resource management problem, and sometimes lack of capacity building. We work also on the gender equity, how to involve women in the development process.
So on that front, is it fair to assume that sort of the population profile consists of largely women, children, and the elderly? I know that there's been a lot of young men in particular who have left even outside of the country, trying to find their way to Europe, for instance. Is the demographic profile largely leaning towards the most vulnerable, mostly women, children, and the elderly?
Yes. When we enter in a community, we focus on the vulnerable people, households. And among them, yes, you have the elderly. You have also children in terms of malnutrition, for example. And you have young person also.
In terms of the profile of the communities that you're helping, you know, are they based in mostly in conflict zone? I know, for example, Mali, there's a lot of conflicts in the north mostly, but obviously down along the border with Burkina Faso and within Burkina Faso border areas, are the needs much bigger in conflict zones as opposed to rural but no political conflict?
Yes, unfortunately, our intervention zones are in the area where many attacks occur. So in Burkina, we are working in the Sahel region and in the eastern region. Those are near the border with Mali and in Niger. In Mali also, the region where we work, it is Segu regions. And there also, we have many attacks. So this attack creates a kind of psychosis in among the communities, and you have a lot of displacement of population. So when people displace, they move without the land. They don't have land. They cannot cultivate anymore. They cannot farm. And sometimes all the assets, the livestock, and even the provision, they just move to save their life. So when they are in this more secure areas, but they lack of many things, this is where humanitarian NGOs give them some support.
Can you talk a little bit about what you see in terms of the school and the health infrastructure in the villages and in the communities?
Yes, in terms of schools, yes, things are getting worse. Because in Burkina Faso, for example, we have more than 2,000 schools closed because of the terrorist attack. Those terrorists, they are targeting schools.
Specifically schools?
Specifically schools.
Because go ahead, sorry.
They are against the Western education. So they target really schools and teachers. Health centers are also targeted. So that is why a lot of workers, health officers, they move also because of the insecurity.
How do you assess the rest of the country, areas that are not affected by the jihadi action in the center and in the south? Obviously, there's probably no as much population displacement. Are you facing similar challenges or are they different?
It is the same challenges, but not in the at the same level. Because even in the south or in the west, sometimes there can be specific attacks there also. But the level of attacks is not the same in regions bordering with Mali and Niger.
And within Mali, to what extent, you know, your organization reaches the north? Because obviously, the center and the north of Mali are the hardest hit, obviously, by the insurgency and the jihadi activity. Are you reaching the north, the center, or are you guys mostly focused on the southern part of the country?
Our intervention here is let's say, the Segu region.
Segu area, okay.
Yeah, the Segu region is like in the center, going to the north. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have one of our commune, Tene, for example. Tene commune, jihadis, sometimes they cross the village.
For the listeners, to position where Segu is, Segu is in the southern part of Mali, slightly northeast of Bamako, the capital city. It's a little stretch to Burkina Faso, which is further to the east. This is probably an area that might be a little more dense in terms of population than in the vast expanses of the north, you know, where the big desert is. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So as you get to Segu, you begin to get into sort of greener areas of Mali, and that's where you probably have a little more concentration of people, not as much as in Bamako, obviously. Tell me a little bit about government support. You know, governments, obviously, in that part of the world are facing unprecedented challenges. Problem number one is stability. As we see in Mali, it's very unstable. The government is extremely unstable. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the resources are very limited. To what extent governments are supportive of what you guys do, what your actions are, or the opposite? Do they create more bureaucracy and more problems?
No, I won't say that they create problems. They are trying to support us in their manner. For example, they create a legal framework. Mm-hmm. In that, if you want to intervene in the country, you have to agree with that with this legal framework. you get a kind of authorization for first to intervene in the case of Burkina, for example, and you have some relationship with governmental offices. For me, for example, as I was working for the government before joining World Neighbor, so it is easy for me to deal with government affairs.
These requirements are largely requirements around security, or are they about structuring your work on the ground, meaning you can do this, you can do this, you cannot do that? Or is it about, okay, if there's a problem, here's what you need to do?
As there are a lot of people intervening in this sector, so they have to organize a little bit. If not, it can be a kind of mess in the within all these on NGOs. That is why they try to build this legal framework. When you enter in that, so they know who you are, who are the representative, what are your objectives in implementing program in Burkina, for example, so they can check if those programs are relevant to the needs of the country and how they can be complementary with the action government is already taking to develop the country.
What we noticed in Nigeria, particularly in the Borno state, the northeast of the country, which is home of Boko Haram, and by extension, it has become a big humanitarian crisis area with all the IDPs and the people that basically have been displaced from their lands. What we've noticed is there's been an influx of humanitarian organizations and aid agencies that have been well-meaning. Now, they meant to do a good job, but what they did is they inadvertently or by accident, they have increased the cost of living because the staff's coming and renting the housing that's in places like Maiduguri, the city there, have made it much more expensive for the locals who needed help, have made it much more expensive. Are you seeing big traffic of NGOs in the Mali, or is it still a manageable environment?
I think it is manageable from now. I can say that the case of Nigeria can't happen in some places in Burkina or in Mali, but I think it is still manageable.
But you say it is possible. I mean, it could happen point.
If it would happen, yes.
I mean, our governments in, at least in Burkina Faso at the moment, because I'm assuming Mali is still in the construction mode, but in Burkina Faso, is the government aware that they have to control sort of the impact, the unintended consequences of having perhaps too many agencies or involved?
Yes, I think it is because of that they elaborate a legal framework from NGO to enter in this so that they can get a look on what is going on the ground, and periodically we send them our activity report to say we have done this and this, so that they can see what we are doing on the ground.
If I know you've joined WN in 2016, so yes. you have almost or about four yes. years observing what's going on. You've been there for a long time as well. WN has been there for decades.
For decades.
What have been the biggest evolution you can think about or you've witnessed taking place in the region? Is it environmental? Is it security issue? What's the number one problem that makes you say, gosh, if I could fix it, that would be the first place I would fix?
I think now in the region, I can say the first issue, the big issue is security. This is a new phenomenon in the case of Burkina. The first attack, they started in 2016 with the first attacks in Ouagadougou, in the hotel. And it's this kind of violence, we are not used to it. And even for the security forces, they have to readapt the way of doing to face this problem. At the beginning, it was foreigners coming from outside. But now, among those who are attacking us I can say our brothers are being involved. Mm-hmm. Security issue is a very big issue now.
Yeah, I think it's clear that terror groups focus largely on recruiting disenfranchised and people who really don't see the future and don't have any resources. So if you come along and you're offering cash and moral support, of course, it gets easier to recruit. So how do you, as an organization, deal with the security aspect of it? I mean, surely, if I were to manage a staff that's going from village to village in the Sahel province up north, I would be extremely worried. And how do you deal with the security aspect of it?
We are in constant contact with our partners on the ground. We are very cautious when we go for field visits. We have to check with the partners. Is it secure at that period to come there? They can say, oh, this moment is not good. You can wait. And then if there a favorable period, they tell us now you can come. That is how we operate. And going on field visits, we kind of to not be very noticeable, visible. For example, we have some stickers, logos from our organization, but we remove all this on our cars so that we can just go there like the normal people going to the village.
And I'm assuming that your staff is exclusively composed of Burkinabes as opposed to Westerners.
Burkinabe. We are all Burkinabe. And on the ground, we have people from coming from the communities there. So the communication is, there's no problem. They speak the local language there, so they can understand what is going wrong, or what is going there on the ground, and advise us on the security issue.
Because of the security crisis that you're facing in Mali and certainly a part of Burkina, have you reduced your work over the past year, 2 years, to avoid the escalating violence?
Yes, because the visit we were doing regularly from the ground, if, for example, the period is not favorable to go there, so we postpone the visit. So we rely on remote support now. Mm-hmm. Phone call, email, to get in contact with our partners. Then there were times when the government advised to avoid, for example, gathering many people. Because if you gather people, it can be an easy target for terrorists to make a lot of victims. So at that period, if you want to, for a training, for example, you have to gather people. So we have to take into account that aspect also.
Yeah, look, I mean, it must be a daunting task to try to help a community in an environment like this, right? At the end of the day, when you talk about development, you talk about stability. You are intervening to help people, to help communities in a very, very difficult area. What is it that's driving you to, you know, a place where you're taking a lot of risks as a human being, as a person, and your colleagues as well? I am certain that you are focusing on specific priority areas and not on everything, particularly when there is danger and risk.
Yes. In our program, we have what we call thematic areas. And in the Sahel, you know that the degradation of lands and the natural resources is very severe. So the security, food security is important. So the first domain we intervene in what we call sustainable agriculture and rural livelihoods. All the activities in agriculture, in livestock, in some income generating activities and saving and credit so that people get food to eat and also revenues to, in case they can purchase food or to face other needs. And the other thematic area is the community-based natural resource management. All we deal with environment, tree nurseries, reforestation, and all that. And you have also health, community and reproductive health. We deal with health issues, family planning, child malnutrition, HIV, and other things.
All of these are still pretty much in your agenda, even if the region is facing security threats. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
It doesn't matter because when we enter in a community, we have what we call a holistic approach. The problem communities face are interrelated. So you cannot just pick a problem and try to solve it because it has links with other problems in the communities. So we can start with one domain, like an entry point, when we initiate the program. But after the program grows and expands to touch the other domain in the communities.
Let me ask you about Mali specifically, because Burkina is, from a government perspective, is a stable country. Mali, as you know, has been going through a very difficult time. For a long time. Where do your operations in Mali stand at the moment? Have you seen anything change since the military has taken over? Or is it the same? As far as you're concerned, it's really no change at the moment.
When the coup d'etat happened and the military was in place, they tried to consult with all the partners involved in that crisis. And now the transition is ongoing, and they are taking action to normalize the situation. But for us, the borders are still closed, so we cannot go in Mali now. And as soon as they will open the borders, this is the first activity we are going to do.
Are you in touch with the folks on the ground, though? What are they telling you is happening on their end? Are you worried, or is it just, you think, a temporary situation, perhaps even a setback, but it's still temporary?
In our area, the situation is stable. They are waiting to see what will happen next. Because the government is the transition government is just in place, mm-hmm. They will try to. I think the first action is to consult all the partners and organize election so that they will renew with a normal constitutional.
When you talk to your peers, your colleagues that are not in your organization, not world neighbors, but other organizations, I'm assuming that you are in contact with similar organizations and share ideas, thoughts, etc. Are they feeling the same way, the ones that are a lot more exposed to Mali crises, or do you think it's different, it's a case by case depending on which organization, which region they are located?
It depends on organization and region that they are intervening. So the south, going from Bamako and Kai, is more secure than the north part. I think in the north part, most of the actors move from there because the situation is very critical. So people are working now around Bamako and more secure regions.
Do you come across the foreign forces, in particular the French? They've been pretty present. On the ground, though, are they as visible or less? Foreign forces tend to stay in their barracks because they tend to get the population angry at them for their presence. Mm-hmm. But do you see them? Do you have to deal with them when you are in conflict zones, or is exclusively the Burkinabe and eventually the Malian governments?
No, we don't meet them, the foreign forces. You know that Barkhane is there, the French forces.
Sure.
Yeah. But no, we have no contact with them.
Okay, so they're not really a factor in shaping the humanitarian sector in a region? You're mostly dealing with a local government. So obviously, this year has been a major challenge for everyone. In an era that people have to isolate, social distance, etc., because of the COVID-19, how does a humanitarian agency like yours cope with what's going on the pandemic front?
Regarding COVID, the government took measures, barrier measures, and they were quarantined, they closed the borders, they closed markets, there was a curfew. So we sensitized our communities on those barrier measures. The gathering of people also, we limited the number of people, number of persons to be gathered from an activity, for example. And we give them advices, sensitization, so that they can deal with the pandemic.
It seems to me that you're helping the local communities understand COVID, and therefore your action may not have been reduced, but perhaps you remained active because of your role in advising on healthcare issues.
Yes, because health is, as I said earlier, health is one thematic area of our program. So we just our topic on COVID in our normal activities.
In the West, you know, Europe, the Americas, the United States in particular, the virus has been extremely contagious, as you know. One of the things that we see through our work in Africa is that in Africa in general, although disastrous, the virus has been less problematic, less disastrous on the population, and the casualty figures, the number of people who've died, etc., have been relatively, compared to the West, subdued and controlled. Can you confirm what is happening within the communities and the villages that you serve? And perhaps can you speculate as to why COVID has been less troubling in Africa, or at least in the regions that you know?
What is clear is that the situation hasn't gone worse like in Europe, for example. But now I'm not sure to say it is because of that or that. We read some analysis about that, but we are waiting for maybe more scientific evidence and to be sure to say that it is because of that or that the death toll is less in Africa. In Burkina, I think the last situation, we are around 65-60-something death.
Yeah, it's relatively low, but specific to the communities and the villages that you know that you serve, what's the attitude of the population there?
It's a bad thing because you see, when, for example, they took measure on social distancing, you know, in Africa, social aspects is very, very important in our relationship. For example, not greeting an elder pupil, an elder, someone who is older than you, this can be considered like the kind of you don't respect that person. It changed the social relation dramatically. People were afraid of the quarantine. When you are detect positive, they isolate you. And in the communities, people were very afraid of that, of this isolation. So they were afraid in going to the health centers, for example, because if they notice that you have some symptoms related to it, they can separate you from your family, and you see, people were afraid of the isolation. Also, they closed the markets in the villages. And you know, in the markets, there are people coming from many villages. So they can sell their products and have some revenues.
Absolutely. I think in the Sahelian context, actually probably in the African context, the market plays a central role in the local economy. You remove the market, you basically remove the economy.
There's not much left.
You know, I guess the gist of my question, we talked about terrorism and violence. We talked about environmental degradation. We talked about sort of all the economic challenges, etc. But where does COVID stand? If COVID is part of, let's say, four or five big topics, is it number one today in the mind of the populations? Because it is here in the U.S. For example, it's so big that it's part of it's affecting even the presidential elections. But I have a sense that it's probably not as big in a region as much as it is, you know, in places like Italy and France and Spain. And
they are taking it seriously. By the time people, they know that people are dying from the disease, so they take it seriously, but not at the same level than in Europe, for example, because they are facing a bigger issue, security crisis.
Yes.
In one attack, for example, it can have many victims at the same time.
From their perspective, that's much bigger than COVID,
yeah,
obviously.
From their perspective, that's much bigger. You see, there was a time terrorists, they came in the livestock markets and they shot at people there, and they killed more than 20 people at the same time.
You know, that speaks about the priorities that people have, right? I agree with you. I think the fact that COVID may be the number one issue in the West is because the other problems, particularly with government bringing support financially and otherwise to people in Europe and North America, COVID then becomes front and center. Whereas in the case of people that you deal with in the Sahel, yeah, that may be important. That is important. But look, we're getting shot every day. But let's switch to environment, if you may. Obviously, the Sahel has long been a hard hit on the environmental front, specifically water. When I think about the Sahel, to me, is water. Without major government investment, especially nowadays with the economy being, you know, hard hit by the global context, the issue of water in particular must be front and center. I mean, for you, because you go there with subsistence farming, but subsistence farming without water, it gets a little bit difficult to manage. Can you talk about that for a few minutes?
As you said, in Sahel, it's characterized by low rainfall, so water is a big issue. But what the government did, they tried to build what we call water reservoirs, the barrage. Mm-hmm. And where the country in Burkina, we have, I can say, more than 1,000 small reservoirs, small water ground, where people can practice irrigation for market gardening, production, and to cope with the length of the rainy period, because the rainy period is normally start from May, June, and end October, November. So it is very short. Eh? We try to give to farmers improved seed that grow rapidly and grow faster, mm-hmm. so that within the period they can harvest something.
Final question, Dr. Christophe. I really appreciate the time you're giving us. Looking at 4 or 5 years from now, I know it's probably even challenging to look at 1 year from now, but give it a try. What do you see happening in the region several years from now? Is it going to be worse? Is it going to be better?
We hope that things will go better. This is our first expectation. But we know that there will be challenges apart from security, apart from health, and apart from climate. You see, at the moment in the region, the elections at the political level, the elections. In Côte d'Ivoire, in Burkina, it is in November 22. In Niger, also they have election there. And you know that what can happen when the election are not well organized with the, what we call some crisis there. So this is another challenge. We don't know how they will deal with this. And other thing is the security crisis. There has been some conflict among communities. You see, communities were living in good manner, but with time, from time to time, there are conflict with the communities, and this is, we have to deal with this to keep living in good manner within the country. And other thing is the youth. Government must take actions towards the youth, because if the youth is not employed, has nothing to do, they are willing to be recruited by those groups to do bad things.
If I summarize what you just said, I think that your number one problem was essentially speaking about security, and you extended it to supporting the youth so that they do not become radicalized. So you're really, the number one issue for you at the moment is security. If you can don't
it's
control
security.
Security.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, it's security.
Do Christophe, thank you very much, sir. You've been fantastic. Look forward to hearing from you again with another podcast in the coming months for an update. And thank you very much.
To find out more about World Neighbors, including how to help and support them through donation, visit wn.org. That is wn.org. And our sincere appreciation for Do Christophe and for World Neighbors for sharing their insight. Thank you for listening. To subscribe to our podcast series, please visit mea-risk.com/audio. That is mea-risk.com/audio to find out more. If you are interested in a 6-month trial for our critical incident awareness and notification system, please visit shield-alert.com. That is shield-alert.com. Until our next podcast, thank you and goodbye.